Yeah, I guess we can start. The last time I saw you several years ago was on the occasion of the little horror novel that you wrote, or Supernatural, I guess.
Right. World Made of Fire.
I think the one with the, I can't remember, the title is...
World Made of Fire.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
One that had a Stephen King blurb, as I recall.
Right.
It's a very nice book. A terrific first effort.
Yeah.
And I remember when you came in, you were loaded down. You must have had three suitcases.
I was new at author touring at that point.
Yeah, I think you had three suitcases, a guitar, and a spare tire.
That's right. And I was trying to get to the airport. I remember that. It was snowing. I remember that evening well.
Oh, yeah. But you got back okay.
Got back okay.
Because back then, you were a working journalist. You were working with the Atlanta Constitution, as I remember.
Right.
But you're no longer in the newspaper business.
No, for 5 years I've just been writing fiction. I'm really lucky.
What a luxury.
Yeah, it is. It's great. Of course, you know, I wait for the next paycheck to come. It's sometimes a nerve-wracking way to live, but it's great. I really enjoy it.
Well, your second book was Victor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't have a chance to talk about Victor. Why don't we work up to Tinder?
Okay.
Just tell me a little bit about, has this come out in paperback?
Yeah, it's been out.
When did it come out in paperback?
89.
Tell me a little bit about Victor.
Well, it's an adventure story for grown-ups. It's set in Mobile Bay in Alabama, which is a place where I lived for about 4 years while I was researching and writing it. And it's an adventure story. It's about a boy who's 16 years old. His name's Victor. And he discovers a Nazi U-boat that's come into Mobile Bay, and it's up to him to capture it. So it's kind of boy versus, you know, Nazi monster. I call it a Hardy Boys book for grown-ups. And there's a little bit of the element of the supernatural in that, too. We're not sure at any time whether the U-boat is real or just a figment of the kid's imagination.
Yeah, when I was a kid, my family lived in Texas, in Houston, and we used to go to Galveston and go to the beach, and we'd see these huge bunkers with cannons facing out to the Gulf of Mexico. And my father would say, Don, he said, look out there, because a German submarine could come along at any moment. And in fact, a couple did.
Oh, it's true. In 1 month in 1942, the Nazis sunk 48 ships in the Gulf of Mexico, which we don't really realize, you know, that they penetrated that deep into our waters.
Yeah.
But it's true. I talked to a lot of people when I lived in Magnolia Springs who had lived there during the war, and there were always rumors that a Japanese submarine had landed or a Nazi submarine had landed, and this had sort of become part of the local folklore. And so I sort of took that and turned it into a story.
Did you resign from the Constitution on the occasion of writing Victor?
I actually resigned and then went to Magnolia to write it. I was working 60 hours a week as regional editor at that paper, and it was a great job. I liked it, but it was tough to go home and write fiction at night. So I saved my pennies and quit my job and moved to the deepest woods of Alabama, where it's not too expensive to live.
Did you have any qualms about this?
Oh, sure. It was nerve-wracking and continues to be. You know, you never know if you're going to have to go back and get a real job. You know, my mom always says, now, are you riding there or are you working? Which I tell her it's the same thing. You know?
Well, I think it's the dream of almost every writer to be able to do it full-time, and the vast, vast majority can't do it. Or some have tried, but they've had to do other things, or go back to work, or take some sort of teaching job or something.
I have my typing skills if I need them. I can always fall back on those.
But you're doing other things, too. Like freelance work. Didn't I see a book? You had a book review.
Right.
I saw recently. What?
In the Times, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do a lot of book reviewing. I write occasional journalism pieces. I've ghostwritten a couple of books. I mean, I've done a lot of things to stay alive as a fiction writer. So I haven't just been sitting around writing novels, but...
Tell me about the ghostwriting.
Well, I can't really talk about that.
In general.
In general. Well, you know, you go in and you
H.L. Mencken wrote a baby book, you know.
Right.
You never had a
baby. Yeah, I'm not ashamed of it. It's just in my contract. I can't talk about, you know, who. But I helped people who had a story to tell and weren't really used to putting together book-length projects. And it was a great way as a freelancer to stay alive, you know.
You're not one of those guys who has an ad in Writer's Digest, do you?
No. No,
offering your ghostwriting service?
No, I haven't got to that level yet.
Well, let's talk about Tinder. Another, of course, all three of your books are set in the South. This one really goes from practically one end of the South to the other, from Florida to Texas and off to California and everything. And obviously it's the character in the book who's I have terrible time with the names. Leroy Kirby
right.
is very much patterned after Elvis Presley. A lot of the events in Leroy's life I recognize from what I know about Elvis Presley, which is not very much, but do you pretty well parallel Elvis Presley's existence?
Yeah, well, Tinder is definitely inspired by the life and the music of Elvis, but and you know, all the great scenes that you think of in terms of Elvis are there. I mean, where he goes to the Ed Sullivan Show and they shoot him from the waist up, and when he's mobbed by the girls at the Gator Bowl and they try to tear his clothes off. But a lot of what I've done in this book is invention. I mean, the first 350 pages are all the events of his childhood, which are more or less completely invented because nobody was taking very, very good notes when he was a kid. So I would say that, you know, this is, you know, Leroy is Elvis in the same way that maybe Charles Foster Kane was William Randolph Hearst in Citizen Kane, or Willie Stark was Huey Long in All the King's Men. They were, but they weren't, you know, and by changing it to fiction and inventing it, you can get closer to the character. You can get inside his head, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to tell it from Leroy's point of view.
And by changing the names and some of the locations and so forth, you don't get crucified too by the people who want an accurate portrayal of their hero.
Well, I hope the reader can just relax into the story of Leroy, you know, whether they're an Elvis fan or not. As a matter of fact, I'm getting a lot of my strongest reaction from people who said, you know, I don't want to read a book about Elvis. I don't care about him. He's not of my generation. I was that way, too, when I started out on this book. And I'm kind of trying to, I don't know, open doors and open people's minds into considering him as a musician and as a human being instead of just this legend that, you know, we've all been left with.
Leroy was very, very sympathetic in this, or is very sympathetic in this book. Even toward the end, where he was criticized for bossing around Bubba a little bit and getting a swelled head, but for the most part, he was very sympathetic and very, very decent. Was Elvis also like that?
I don't really know how Elvis was. I mean, all I know is what I've read in the biographies, which are, as far as I can tell, mostly fiction themselves. I mean, there are as many different points of view on him as there are people who've written about him. I happen to take a sympathetic viewpoint because I'm from the South. I'm from the same kind of people that he's from. I understand, you know, where he comes from, you know, geographically and linguistically and the kind of people he grew up around. So when I got into the book, I think a novelist's job is always to have sympathy for his characters, and I found that I really liked Leroy.
Yeah, I did too. Did you, the research that you did, was it only in reading the biographies, or did you go to the places that Elvis actually lived? Or
well, I read everything I could find that had been written about him, and I went to Memphis about four or five times, went to Graceland each time, and paid my money and asked him a lot of rude questions, like, why are all the costumes have 32-inch waists? You know, we know that's not accurate. Some friends and I went into Sun Studio, rented an hour of recording time, made some music in there. And I spent some time in Tupelo, ran around. But I didn't interview anybody. I didn't research it as I would have if it were a biography, because I wanted to be free to tell my version of it, you know, to invent it.
The music in the book, the song sounds so familiar, but I have a feeling that they're also the product of your invention.
Right. I wrote songs for Leroy to sing because I didn't want him, you know, singing somebody else's songs. And I'm kind of an amateur wannabe musician myself, so it seemed easiest to write lyrics if you had music to go with them. So I actually wrote songs for each of the songs that are in the book.
What do you play?
Yeah, I play piano and keyboards, and I try to sing a little. When I was in high school, I was in the band. I've got friends that we've had sort of garage bands for lots of years, so I've always been interested in music and playing rock and roll.
So you actually composed the music? Well, you don't have the notes or anything in the book, but you do have the lyrics.
Right.
There is actually music to go with them?
There are songs to go with them. We even, my friends and I, as the Lee Royals, went into a studio and recorded a couple of the tunes, which was a lot of fun to do. I think I'm definitely a writer, not a singer, but it was kind of an occasion for fun.
Well, for production purposes, if I were to grab a cut of Elvis singing Love Me Tender, that would be off the mark, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but I hope that one of the effects that this book has on people is to send them back to his early music, too, because I really found that it was exciting. That was what inspired me to write the book in the first place. Somebody gave me a copy of the Sun Sessions, and I had never seriously sat down and listened to his music before, and I got really turned on by it. You know, I had to move around. I couldn't sit still. So I just kind of wanted to let people of my generation know that, you know, here's the guy who started all the rock and roll that we listen to today. And if you want to understand the kind of music that we're hearing, you really ought to go back and look at the roots of it and see where he got it. You know, he didn't just spring full-blown on the scene. He listened to a lot of different kinds of music himself and sort of blended them.
But well, that's odd. You just said that you had not really listened to his work before, but somehow I pictured you as always being, although you're of a different generation, I pictured you as being a fan.
I wasn't a fan at all. No, I was a Beatles baby. I mean, I grew up, you know, Elvis was who your friend's older sisters listened to. So I was an Elvis fan, but I was an Elvis Costello fan, actually, for years. I liked the new wave and rock. But I think there's a time when you grow up and you start listening to other things than what you're supposed to in your generation. You start listening to early jazz, or you start listening to classical music. Maybe you didn't as a kid. So as I've gotten older, I guess my tastes have gotten a little wilder, and I'm kind of getting into this early rock and roll and the R&B.
Well, if you were not a fan of Elvis as such, what prompted this interest in him?
Somebody gave me a copy of the Sun Sessions, and the music was so great. And I, in my callow youth, I had not considered that he might indeed be a good musician. I mean, I knew him as the guy in the sequin outfit, you know, singing My Way. He came to perform at the University of Alabama when I was in school there, and I didn't go to see him. I didn't care about him at all. But when I listened to that music, it really turned me on. I thought it was great, and I thought, he's been legendized to such an extent and mythologized that I never considered he might have been a good musician, and that was what started it all. So, I don't know, that kind of struck me like a discovery, and I decided I wanted to write about him.
Yeah, well, I came out of the big band era, and I remember in 1959, I think, I was doing a radio talk show, a very early radio talk show in Huntington, West Virginia, and these girls would call the station to go on the air, and they would say, do you think that Elvis is going to be able to have a real comeback when he gets out of the service? You know, things like that. And I didn't know what to respond because I was a young college grad, you know, and I liked Les Brown and the Band of Renown and this sort of thing. And I really could care less about Elvis, you know. I was very contemptible at that time. At that same station, Flat and Scruggs would pull up in their Martha White Flower van, you know, and do on the television side of the corridor, they would do a television jamboree every Saturday night. This was WSAZ-TV in Huntington. And I was so contemptuous. Never did I dream then that I would somehow learn to play the banjo years later. And you know, I could have gone up there, old Scruggs, and touched him and picked up his banjo, you know.
Exactly.
So it's amazing the kinds of things that you ignore at the time that they are important.
It's true. And I guess you have to go through these stages growing up. I mean, that's the great thing about having recorded music is that, you know, we can go back and listen to early Elvis now. You know, if he had lived 100 years ago, we just had to rely on the word of anybody who'd heard him. So I think it's great, and I think that it's fun to discover music that was good in another time and discover that it's really still good music.
Now, Mark, you take Tender up through approximately 1959, and it ends with Elvis getting on a troop ship in New York. Is this only the beginning? Is this half of the story or what?
I think it's the whole story. Now, several people have asked me, when are you going to write the sequel? And I never say never about anything, but to me, the part of the story that I tell from his beginning until the time when his mother dies and he goes into the army, that's the interesting part of the story. I remember reading a quote from John Lennon. They asked him how he felt when he heard that Elvis died, and he said he died the day he went in the army. And in some ways, I think that was really true. He was, you know, those girls were calling you in Huntington saying, is he going to be able to make a comeback? That was really the beginning of the end for him. He was never the biggest thing in the world again. I mean, ever in his life. It was all, you know, there were comebacks and there were good points for him, but he was never the hottest thing. And that's, to me, the rest of his story is not only implied in what I've written. I mean, you can see him beginning to drink and to take drugs and to turn inward, you know, onto himself. But at the same time, I also felt that the rest of the story is a story we all know. I mean, that's what most of the books that have ever been written about him, you know, concentrate on the later period of his life. To me, the interesting part was, how did he become this? How did he invent himself? You know, he's a poor white kid from Tupelo, Mississippi. How did he set styles for a whole generation? And so I thought the parts that I told were the parts that needed to be told.
I have a suspicion, though, that you'll be thinking about Elvis in the months or years to come, wondering how he is going to turn out, I mean, in a fictional way, and what you might be able to do with that.
Well, it's conceivable, but I like to
be tempting, I think.
I like to do something different every time. I like to keep the critics guessing, you know. I don't want to be one of these writers that writes the same book over and over again, because to me, if it's different, then it's interesting, and I want to write it.
Well, you even have some supernatural elements in Tender, as Elvis looks into the mirror, and he's talking, in effect, to his dead twin brother. So there is a kind of a super. Of course, maybe it's more hallucinatory than supernatural.
Well, his mother also is kind of psyche, as they say. She plays with the Ouija board. She has omens and portents a lot, visions. I think anybody who's read all three of my novels sees that that's a line that definitely runs through all three of them. I'm very interested in the Latin American writers, Marquez and Borges and Cortazar and all these guys who like to trace the place where, you know, realism butts up against magic, where, you know, things are true if people believe them. And I guess that's one of my obsessions and one of my interests in writing fiction, is to explore that gray territory.
Now, tell me a little bit about your approach to writing. With Tender, it was, I would assume, fairly easy because, well, not easy, but in terms of structure, because you're in effect following the pattern of Elvis's life, as opposed to some of the other books which spring completely from the imagination or partially from the imagination. So when you sit down to write, actually, how do you approach the effort of putting the words on paper and creating a work of fiction?
Well, first off, it really wasn't any easier, and it isn't any easier, because although, you know, I'm not having to invent the story whole, I'm having to deal with what you, the reader, already know about Elvis and what you think about him and what your opinion may be. And yet I'm trying to get you, even if you don't like Elvis, to continue to read this book, sympathize with his character, and go into the boy's head. So to me, the parts of it that made it easier were compensated for by the other parts that made it harder. In writing fiction, I find it gets no easier with the years. The page is just as blank every time. You know less about what you're trying to do, and you realize how much less you know and how much harder you're going to have to work the next time to write a good book, you know?
Well, I wonder about that, because it would seem to me like any job, you build on your skills, you build on your experience, and many of the techniques that a fiction writer must use, it would seem to me, you learn over a period of time, so some of these things would be easier, don't you think?
I would think they would be, but I haven't found that to be true. I don't know. Like I say, if you're trying to do something different every time, you're really setting yourself a new task, so you're going into territory that you haven't covered before, and it presents all new challenges. For every bit that you gain in your craft, you know, maybe you've read more, and so you realize how many more good books there are out there that you're trying to equal. So I think the more you learn, the more you realize you have to learn.
Yeah, John Barth is a prime example of what you were saying. If you read any of his earlier things, like The End of the Road and the one about the his very first book, which was about riverboat or something. I can't remember.
You got me.
I've read it years and years and years ago. But they were really conventional novels. But the more he wrote, the more experimental he became. So that in some of his later works, in one of his books, and I interviewed him on the occasion, that one particular book, the title which escapes me again, he is speaking in twin voices. Two people are narrating simultaneously. And it's the task of the reader to figure out which one is talking at a given time. And it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult. And another book called Letters was an extremely difficult book to read. But he is one who is trying to stretch the limits of his imagination. I'm not sure how successful he's been at doing it, but it's an effort not to go back to a conventional novel.
Well, I certainly understand the impulse to try to do something new and different. I mean, that's what we're all trying to do. There are no new stories. You're just trying to tell them in a new way. So I think writers who are in it for the long haul definitely try to challenge themselves and to do something harder than they did before. There's no sense in going back and writing the same book again. It might, you know, make money for you more easily, but at the same time, you know, writers usually, I know I'm not in this business for the money. I mean, you're in it to see what you can discover about what you know. And the only way you learn to write novels is to write them. I started writing them when I was 22 years old. I'm 33 now. I still don't feel like I know how to write novels yet. I don't suppose you ever feel like you've, you know, achieved wisdom in that. You know, Hemingway died struggling with a manuscript, and he was pretty good all the way through his life.
Yeah, yeah. It's a tough racket, and I wonder about crusty old critics like Alfred Kazin, who's been writing criticism probably longer than anybody. I think his first work of criticism was in the New York Times in 1938 or 39, and someone sends him a book to review, and he looks at it and he says, "I've read this book. I read this book in 1944. I read this book in 1948. I read it in 1953. So, I mean, there are people who say don't write what's been done before. But I have a feeling most of us have to cut, most writers have to cut their teeth and probably have to do what has been done before. But they can do it in their own way, with their own perspective.
There are very few revolutionaries, truly, in any art, you know. I think Shakespeare stole all of his stories. He told them in a new way, and his language was better than the people who had told them to him, but every one of his plots was borrowed. So I think all fiction writing works together. You borrow from who you read and who you like, and you take bits from this and bits from that, bits from your own life, and you try to do something new with it.
Well, when I was in college, I was a journalism major, but I also took creative writing, and I remember my creative writing teacher, a man named Hollis Summers, said, there are only 6 plots in the entire world. And so I said, "But professor, what are they? What are they?" So I'm not going to tell you.
You have to find them out. Huh?
And so I'm still trying to figure out what the 6 plots are, because he refused to let me know. Now, you, where did you say you're living now, Mark?
I'm living in San Francisco.
Oh, you moved.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you shift from the South?
I move a lot. I grew up moving around. My father was transferred a lot in his job. So I don't know, after a year or two, I get to feeling antsy. It's time to pack my bags and go somewhere else. But I moved to San Francisco because I love it. It's a beautiful city. And when I went there 10 years ago, I said, someday I want to live here for a while. So my job is one that I can carry with me, so I moved out there.
Well, I assume that your future novels are going to draw on your own experience and probably be set for the most part in the South.
Well, maybe. I don't know, you know. You do have to write out of the experiences that you have, but as I move around and get new experiences, I mean, I don't want to be seen as strictly a Southern writer. I grew up in the Midwest and all over the place, so I have kind of an outsider's viewpoint of being a Southerner. I was a Yankee before I was a Southerner, really. But, yeah, I think I'm essentially a Southern boy, and I write about what my life has been, and so I think they'll mostly be set in the South.
Do you teach at all?
No.
No? Do you have any desire to do it?
Nobody's ever asked me. I teach at writers' conferences and these sorts of things. I think I would prefer to make my living writing if I can, because I'm not sure you. If you're around as much bad fiction as you have to be to teach a creative writing course, I'm not sure that it doesn't have an influence on you over time. All the people I know who teach and try to write say don't ever teach.
Did you read this new novel by T. Garagason Boyle?
I haven't seen it yet.
East is East. It's set at a writer's conference in Georgia, on an island off the Georgia coast. It's hilarious. Because the people who attend it, they jockey for power. and they're very competitive, and they're nasty to each other. It's absolutely hilarious. But you have taught at workshops like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've done.
What are they like?
A lot of writers' conferences. I'll have to read his book to see if he got it right. But yeah, they can
and
be.
And he has
very,
never been to one.
They can
he
be
made it up.
They can be very intense places to be. I mean, I've been to Breadloaf, and it's definitely like boot camp for writers. I mean, it's like you're in there with the big boys, and you have to read your stuff in front of them, and it can be scary. Also, writing is so personal. So many people do it for years and years in the privacy of their own homes, and then they creep out and go to a writer's conference and, you know, bare their egos and their souls. That I tend to be a very generous and probably over-generous teacher. I think it takes great nerve even to show your work to other people. So yeah. I try not to discourage people.
Well, I think a writer needs all the encouragement he can get. I almost went to Breadloaf this past August. In fact, I allocated the month off for that purpose, and at the last minute I chickened out and decided not to go. Do you think that's a worthwhile thing, a conference like Breadloaf?
Really, definitely. Yeah, any young writer that has a chance to go, I would definitely go. Because I made, just for the sheer number of friends that I made, that I still have, it's great to be around other people who are fighting the same struggles you are. And you sit around and you talk about agents and you and you scream about print runs and it's somehow it's not such a lonely profession after that. It's really good for us to come out of our rooms once in a while and mingle. Also some of the greatest conversation I've ever heard in my life. It was pretty all those verbal people trapped on a mountain, you know. It was great.
Now, I think you mentioned to Jill something about the Old Boy Network. Because I guess you can start a network or join a network.
That's right. We're trying to start the Young Boy Network.
Yeah.
And girl.
Well, Mark, it was great seeing you again after all these years. And Tinder is a book that's fast, easy to read. It's a big book. I mean, it's almost 600 pages. But it's a book, it's kind of discouraging to a writer. It probably took you a couple of years to write this thing, and to have some guy read it in a day.
That's exactly what I like to hear. Now, that's that's the kind of book I like to read, is one that you can't stop. You have to stay up too late. So when I hear that, that's the biggest compliment you can give me as a writer.
Well, I did stay up too late. In fact, it was about 3 o'clock this morning when I finally, because I also read Jill McCorkle's book. I read both of these books yesterday.
It's fast reading.
So, her book was a little slower, just the way it was structured. I was talking to William Gass, who was kind of like John Barth, you know, kind of an experimental postmodernist, I think they're called. And books do have their own speed. And he said, if you read a book and you try to speed it up, it's like trying to speed up Mozart.
That's really true.
And sometimes if I try to speed up a book, I mean really speed it up, I get lost.
Or you lose interest in it.
No, I don't lose interest, but I sometimes realize a new character has been introduced in a subtle way, and I missed it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to go back and find the character, or something will happen. Because sometimes when you speed read, you look at paragraphs, you know, and everything blends.
Right.
I tell you what you can read really fast are genre novels, like mysteries, because they lay out everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll have sentences like, "And he said angrily," you know, this sort of thing. It spells it all out for you, so you can read that really fast.
Right.
But a piece of literary work, you know, there are more subtleties to it. It's slower. Well, two things I like to talk about: computers and books. And this was certainly a good one, Mark Childress. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.